You are listening to Once a Raider, Always a Raider on the official Raiders Podcast Network. Here's your host, Jerry Knapp.
Welcome to a Once a Raider, Always a Raider. I'm your host, Jerry Knack. This is the premiere of this new podcast, taking a look back at Raiders history. And I am joined by very, very special guest, the great Tom Flores, Super Bowl winning head coach, first quarterback in Raiders history. Tom, welcome to the premiere of this new podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. It's fun to be here. It's always fun to be around the Raider Nation and around, you know, I've been around here since 1960. You can't get rid of me.
Well, we obviously don't want to do that. Tom, this is a new medium for you after 20 years as color commentator on the radio broadcast. Now we are bringing your stories, your experience, and anecdotes to a whole new audience on the internet with podcast technology, which really has been around for a number of years now, but is not slowing down, is continuing to gain popularity. And this is expanding our reach in talking to the Raider Nation and bringing them great stories from you. And you get to reach a whole new audience as well.
Yeah, it's exciting. You know, there's so much of this industry that I don't even understand. When you said podcast, what's a podcast? I have no idea what a podcast is. But I hear it more and more now, and I mean, you can reach everywhere. I mean, it's just, it's almost overwhelming sometimes. I think this industry has grown faster than we're ready for.
I would agree with that. And the great thing about podcasts, too, is, you know, when you listen to radio, and, you know, I worked in radio for a little while when I was in the military with Armed Forces Radio, you know, if you miss a program, you miss a program. And the great thing with podcasts is you can listen to it anytime, just about anywhere. You can listen to it on your smartphone. You can plug your smartphone into your car and listen to it on the road, which is great around here for Raider Nation with the commuting. So this is basically a portable radio program people can listen to anytime they like.
Yeah, I guess it's all over the country, too.
Absolutely.
I was talking to Howie Long's wife last night, Diane, and she said she heard me the other day on some podcast that I was on. I can't remember which one it was, but she says she listens all the time.
Yeah, and it's wonderful. Every genre you can think of, from true crime to radio dramas to obviously sports. So Tom, let's go back in time a little bit here and go back to 1960 when you first joined the team, and you know, you get into training camp and you had 12 quarterbacks on a roster. Eventually you start the season. It's you and Babe Parilli are the quarterbacks. How would you describe that style of offense that you played that first year?
Pretty vanilla, really. Everybody, we did the same thing that the National Football League was doing at the time, playing a four-down lineman, 4-3 defense, four linemen, three linebackers, and four defensive backs. And you never substituted. You know, you stayed that way, first down, second down, third down, goal line, short yardage. It was just, that's the way it was. You substituted one guy at a time. Defensively, you stayed with four defensive linemen the whole time and three linebackers. So in that respect, it was pretty easy. When you think about it, you didn't have to account for all the different blitzes. If they blitzed, there was just those guys that were blitzing that were on the field all the time. So that was the way it was, and it was pretty vanilla as far as the running game. Two backs in the backfield. Fullback is a primary blocker. No I formation. No spread. When you think back, it was exciting because there were still exciting players. I mean, you had guys like Jimmy Brown playing the game, and they made it exciting. But as far as the passing of the ball, it wasn't as exciting in the passing game.
Well, that first year, the way you described it, you know, just about anybody in the backfield could throw a pass, you know. And Tony Teresa becomes the primary running back, leads the team in rushing that first year. But, you know, some of the other guys in the backfield with you, there was always that run-pass option.
Yep. Run-pass option. Tony Teresa was a option quarterback in college at San Jose State. So he when he tried out with the 49ers a year before, he tried out as a defensive back and was cut, one of the final cuts, and then when the Raiders started up here, he signed and came in. The first day or two was almost like tryout camp because they were moving guys all over the place. Like the 11, 12 quarterbacks, four of them went home and four of them went to other positions, of which Tony Teresa was one of them, and Wayne Crow from the University of California was another one. They went to different positions, and they had a nice career in doing so. But it was, you know, it was first come, first serve. You get a look, and then you better not screw up because you're bus coming, bus going.
At what point did it really start to look and feel like what we know as a pro-style offense?
Well, it really did in 63 when Al Davis came to town because he had a better feel for professional football. He had been active with the National Football League and scouting for them and going to their camps and watching as much football as he possibly could. The people before him, with all due respect, did not know what they were doing. So we didn't progress. In 61, we signed one draft choice. Of all of our draft choices, we brought in very few new players, and everybody in the league, well, almost everybody else, did, and we just got killed in 61. And 62, same thing. Al came to town and immediately started changing things, and we started going into what was more fun, especially in the American Football League, which is pretty wide open in those days and continue to be wide open.
Well, it's interesting, and you mentioned 1961, and that draft pick was running back George Fleming, who turned out to be a better kicker than a running back.
He had the record for a long, long time, and he was a conventional kicker with a square toe, and kicked that. The field goal was kicked at Candlestick Park, where we were playing then, and the winds at Candlestick were just atrocious. You could throw a ball, and it would come right back to you sometimes, or you could throw a ball and go 20 yards over the guy's head. And he turned around and looked at you, what the heck are you doing? And we had Wayne Crow as our punter. He punted one for minus 1 yard.
Oh, my.
He went out of bounds, came back all the way out of bounds.
Well, that field goal you referred to with Fleming, that was 54 yards, and that stood all the way until a guy you were very familiar with, Jeff Jaeger, came in. And Jeff tied that record at 54. And I couldn't imagine kicking at Candlestick. I remember when Sebastian Janikowski was here and he talked about kicking in Candlestick and absolutely hated it. I couldn't imagine trying to play a football game there.
Well, initially the whole center field was open. It wasn't an enclosed stadium. And when it was open, the winds howled there. And I don't know, somebody sold somebody a bill of goods to build that thing there because that was their. Everybody knew that it was a windy area, windy part of the Bay Area, but it lasted a long time. It was one of the dinosaurs of the league. For you know, there was a point in time where, with all due respect, because you know the football's been great everywhere, especially at Candlestick and at the Raider Stadium, San Diego. Those were the three oldest stadiums in the National Football League at one time.
Wow. And the thing about Candlestick, I had watched a documentary some time ago that if they had taken that stadium and built it one stadium with right or one stadium with left, they would have never had the wind problems that they did. But there was this, because of the topography there, it created this perfect wind tunnel right into Candlestick Park.
Yeah, sure did. And, you know, somebody didn't do their homework. But nowadays, every little part of building a stadium is considered when you build. Although I don't know about the Niners, I think the sun is a problem over there. So somebody didn't check the sun out.
Yeah, I've heard that as well. You're listening to Once a Raider, Always a Raider. I'm your host, Jerry Nack, and I'm joined by Raiders legendary player and coach, Tom Flores. Tom, let's talk a little bit about the mid-60s. You mentioned it a little bit ago when Mr. Al Davis came in and things really started to change. What was the growth like during that time period? You go from 1-13 in 62, a season that you missed due to illness, but in 63 you go 10-4. It's one of the greatest worst-to-first turnarounds in all of sports history, not just professional football. What was that time like for you?
That was an exciting time. It was a a period of awakening, I call it, because all of a sudden you realize, wow, you know, this is fun, and we're pretty good, and the league's pretty good, and you know, we're not far from being competitive with the National Football League, who had been in existence for a long time. And you know, we were starting to sign our drafted players. Fred Valentikoff was one of our drafted players in the mid '60s, along with other guys that were we got traded for Billy Cannon. So there were some big name stars that we were finally starting to get and were producing, and some of the areas were drawing pretty good crowds. But the thing that really changed was the television coverage. Television coverage just made professional football what it is today, because everything that television does is perfect for football.
I would definitely agree with that. Even though, you know, a lot of people grew up listening to it on the radio, but television just changed the game. And when the AFL, when the American Football League, got that second television contract in the mid-60s, that seemed to really propel the league. And with Mr. Davis and that TV contract, it really started to propel that merger between the AFL and the National Football League.
Yeah, and plus when Al went to be the commissioner of the American Football League, that kind of propelled it even more so. That gave him a real kick. They didn't like it too much, but he had a plan, and he sped up the process of the merger. Let me put it that way. And then there was nothing for him to do, so he came back to Oakland and came in as a general partner.
During that time, before you were traded to Buffalo from 63 to 66, who were some of the players? You mentioned Billy Cannon and a couple other guys, but who were some of the other guys that either grew up with the team from the beginning like you did, and some of the guys that came in and really made an impact?
Well, Jim Otto and I, and a teammate of mine in college named Wayne Hawkins, were the original Raiders on offense and from day one. And Jim, as everybody knows, played a long time into the 70s, mid-70s, and Hall of Famer. And Wayne Hawkins played 10 years in the league. I played 10 years in the league. It was just it's kind of a magical time for us, because the magic was that we got paid. And we didn't get paid a lot, but we got paid. And the growth of it, you know, your eyes are just wide open sometimes when some of the things are happening. We were more known on the East Coast than we were on the West Coast, because the East Coast loves their football. And when you're back there, you realize in the wintertime there's not a lot to do except follow the football team. So we would go back East, and they knew us well. But we had a guy named Art Powell, who was a great receiver. And at one time we had Art and Billy Cannon and Fred Biletnikoff as our two wides, and Billy was playing tight end at the time. And Clem Daniels, who's still with the organization as far as support, was a wonderful running back. We got him in 61. And Ben Davidson, a name of the past, was one of the guys that we got that was they tried to make an offensive player out of him and defensive, but he matured when we got him. And he became a force and very well known around the league. So that, you know, those are some of the guys that were coming into the league at the time and playing well.
You had a really good run as a quarterback in the American Football League with the Raiders, the Bills, the Chiefs. When you retired from playing, what drove you into coaching? Why did you want to coach?
That's an interesting story, because I hadn't planned on coaching, but I knew I missed the sport. There was no one that wanted me to go to camp. And at that stage, I was in my early 30s, close to about 33, 34, I guess. And at that point, I didn't want to go in and try out with some rookie for a third-string quarterback. So I had semi-retired and gone in local. I lived locally. I lived right here in Lafayette in the Bay Area, and I had three kids, and I started working for a friend of mine in a small business, and then working with one of the announcers in San Francisco to try to see if I could do any sports with him. And about that time, I got a call from Buffalo, New York, that the coach there had quit 2 days before training camp started. And a fellow named Harvey Johnson, who I knew when I was in Buffalo, and he said, "You're the only one that knows this offense," because it was kind of the Raider offense. "So I need you to help me." So they made it worth my while, so I flew back there, and overnight I was coaching in the National Football League and running the offense. So that was a big jump for me. That's how I got into coaching. When the season was over, it was only a one-season job. I came back home, and about that time there was an opening with the Raiders. I called Al. He put me in touch with John Madden. John and I interviewed, and then I was hired, and that's 1972.
So John Madden's the head coach up until 1978, and he's, you know, we all know John Madden. We know how bombastic and how the histrionics on the sideline and some of the quotes, you know, one of my favorites is, "Never mind the horse being blind, just load the wagon." Mm-hmm. You are the polar opposite of John Madden from a personality and a style standpoint. What was that like, taking over as head coach from John Madden, especially somebody who was kind of the polar opposite of you?
I don't think it was it wasn't a big transition for me, and I don't know that it was that much for the team. I was there for 7 years with John, so when I and we had basically this a lot of the same players, because there wasn't free agency then. There wasn't the salary cap then. There wasn't all the movement that you see nowadays in the National Football League. So when I took over, I was just moving, you know, from one office to the next. So I didn't change. I changed some of the subtle things, my philosophy as far as the passing game, which I learned from Al, and was still learning from Al because he was always around. And I always wanted to contribute, and I was fine. So I didn't have a problem with that, because he was a football guy. But the transition was pretty simple. Same guys that I knew, same guys that I'd worked around. They knew my temperament. They knew my personality, and we had enough leadership that accepted it. And you know, the whole thing was, you just have to win.
You were able to win two Super Bowls as the head coach of the Raiders, Super Bowl 15 and Super Bowl 18. Obviously, you don't win a Super Bowl without great players, without a great roster. Who were some of the best players you ever coached?
Some of the best players I ever coached. Well, probably Ted Hendricks was the most dominating defensive player I've ever been around, because he could do it all. I mean, during the course of a game and at the end of the game, you'd look at the film, and he had blocked a field goal, gotten a sack, caused a fumble.
gotten an interception.
He was a playmaker, and he was a game changer. I mean, and he was kind of a different type of nature. He's so of a football player, because he was so tall. He could see so well, and he's smart. One thing about these great players, they're very bright. Marcus Allen was fun to coach, and a great player. Kenny Stabler before him, I coached him 1 year as a head coach, but I had him as an assistant when I was an assistant, because I worked with him a lot. Jim Plunkett, Cliff Branch, Howie Long, saw him come in as a 20-year-old rookie, just turned 21, and saw him develop and grow into a great player, and now super announcer, and kept his head on straight, worked hard at it. Mike Haynes, one of the great corners of all time. I thought probably the best corner that I've ever been around. You want me to go on?
I know. We could practically read off the roster from that time period. You're listening to Once a Raider, Always a Raider. I'm your host, Jerry Nack, and I'm joined by the great two-time Super Bowl winning champion head coach and first ever quarterback in Raiders history, Tom Flores. Tom, one of the things that I've noticed, you know, in my career with the Raiders, and also prior to that as a fan, was that the Raiders have always had a legacy at certain positions. We could talk about, you know, Ray Guy at punter, followed by Shane Leckler. We could talk about how, you know, you were followed by LaMonica and then Kenny Stabler and then into Jim Plunkett. So there's that threat at quarterback. But one of the positions that doesn't seem to get a whole lot of notice and recognition, and we've got a guy now who's gone to multiple Pro Bowls in Rodney Hudson, is that center position. And as a quarterback, you had the opportunity to play with Jim Otto, a Hall of Fame center, played for 15 years. Let me read off a little bit on Jim. He played in the fourth most games in Raiders history with 210, the most consecutive with 210. He is a 12-time All-Star, Pro Bowl and AFL All-Star, and played for 15 years, third longest career in Raiders history. Then we transition to Dave Dalby and then Don Mosbar. And you had the opportunity to know and either play with or coach all three of these gentlemen. What was it about Jim Otto, and what did you think? What was your initial impression of Jim Otto, and what was it about Jim that made him so good?
Well, the first day of training camp in Santa Cruz, he lined up as a linebacker, really. He was not a real big – he hadn't grown yet. He was about 220 pounds or maybe a little bit more. And he could really snap the ball well for punts and field goals. And he was a center linebacker in college. And he would put that big size 8.5 helmet on you all the time. He had an incredible explosion at the line of scrimmage. And I noticed that right off the bat. And he could really pop the ball into your hands. It sounds kind of funny. He had a high butt. Which means I didn't have to crouch down to get the ball from center. In those days, we didn't play shotgun. So you took the ball from the center, and he had that high stance where his rear end was high. I could stand and almost stand straight up and still receive the ball. And he was gone in a – you just – in a flash, he would be on somebody. And he never stopped. And he never – it's hard to get him out of the game – he'd be bloody every game. He'd be bloody. And he wore that regular helmet, regular face mask. He didn't wear the big cage like most linemen do or did at that time. But anyway, and he was my buddy. We all hung out together, he and I. And I always hung out with the offensive linemen because they're the ones that protect the quarterback. So you better buy them some beer sometimes. So we used to do a lot of stuff together. And we all came in together. You know, Jim and I came in together and Wayne Hawkins and then – pretty soon, Clem Daniels came the next year, and there's some other guys. So those of us that were the old-timers hanging on, we hung out together, and here we are still many years later and just with them a little bit last night watching the game.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing about Jim was you said it. He never came off the field, you know, and he played in 210 consecutive games. That's unheard of.
Yeah.
Especially at a position like center where you're constantly banging. And he played against some monsters back then, you know, the Chargers and the Chiefs and, you know, the Jets had some guys. The Bills had a particularly tough defense in the mid-60s, led them to two AFL championships. What was, you know, did you ever marvel at Jim at the time and think, wow, this guy's really tough?
Yeah, well, I felt, and I still do to this day, and he's proven that he's probably one of the toughest guys I've ever known, tough to a fault where he should have come out maybe. He shouldn't have played with that injury. He should have had it taken care of sooner. He's had so many surgeries that, you know, he's lucky that he can still maneuver, and although he has some trouble now. But he was just that guy. I mean, he'd be bleeding, and he didn't want a Band-Aid or any medication. He was just a tough guy that loved the game. He loved practice. It's interesting because he and the next guy that we're going to talk about loved the game, and they loved to be in the locker room. They loved the practice, and a lot of players don't like practice. They love training camp. They did it all. They had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun in those days. Training camp was a lot different than it is nowadays.
Well, you know, you had a guy come right in behind Jim in Dave Dalby who, you know, picked up right where Jim left off. And that had to be, and you as an assistant coach with the team at the time, that had to be a comforting thing for Kenny Stabler and anyone else on the team, that you had a capable guy who was able to come right in and contribute right away.
Absolutely. And it's an interesting story about that, because we were in training, we were in preseason, and Jim was going to retire, but he wanted one more pop. He wanted to go in and make one more block. And so John puts him in the game, and it was a preseason game, and he goes hobbling out there because his knee was killing him. He hobbles out there, and he lines up in the huddle and breaks the huddle like he always did in that little trot to the line of scrimmage. And then he popped somebody on the defensive side of the ball. And then with a big smile, he came running off the field, limping off the field. So a big smile on his face, he got his last pop on the field, and he could stick you, boy. He could do that. And so that was, and then from then on, he just went on. He went into the front office, and he's been around since. He's at almost every home game, and he doesn't travel as well anymore. But I see him as much. He and Sally, we've been close friends for a long, long time.
Well, you know what? We're going to hear from Jim. Not that long ago, I had the opportunity to sit down with Hall of Fame center Jim Otto for a lengthy conversation. We riffed on everything from the early days all the way through that moment where he decided that he had had enough and he was going to call it a career, and he definitely wanted to go out his way. And one of the things that he has told me numerous times in the time that I've had the pleasure to know him is that he would do it all over again. Here he is. My interview with Hall of Fame center Jim Otto.
I came into San Francisco, landed in the airport there, and I'm stumbling around with thousands of people in that airport. It was so crowded. I was very excited, though. I had a chance to play professional football as it was, and we hadn't even snapped a ball yet, I can remember coming in there with my duffel bags full of my gear from University of Miami. I had my own helmet. Because my head is so big, I had 8 1/8 helmet size. And the Raiders sprayed it black, because that was our helmet with a gold stripe in the middle.
Right.
And I went out to play. And from the first day I was there, I was hitting everything that was on the other side of the line. You know, I just wanted to play football so bad. I had a great time. I really did. I enjoyed the competitorship and everything about it. I was wearing a uniform that was not like the University of Miami, but it was black with gold and white on it. It was a tremendous feeling for me to be able to be accepted by this group, whether it was the American Football League or National Football League. I didn't care. I was going to be, and I was going to help make it the best league in the country. It was going to be better than the National Football League, and that's what I always had in my heart, that we could do that. The guys that I hung around with on our team were guys that had a similar attitude, and I tried to always be a leader in that regard and have my team following me and I following them and being with them and everything else.
What was Eddie Ertelatz like as a head coach?
Eddie Ertelatz was I really enjoyed the man. He was a real leader. I think that it was probably, I think he took us, we only had a couple wins that year. But, you know, being at Navy, being with those guys, there was a lot of esprit de corps with the Navy and everything, and he led those teams. Our team was a little different. We had guys that were, you know, wrestling, and they're tough guys. They came up and they fit into our team, and And Eddie, you know, and his team, he had a couple assistant coaches from the Navy, you know, from the Academy, and they were just a little bit different coaches than, but they were, we were all young guys. Most of us guys were young guys, not too far out of college. I just got out of college, and so I was just taking a step from the University of Miami football field onto a football type organization called the Oakland Raiders, and I was ready to go upwards, onward and upward. I looked at NFL players in those days like, I can do it. And the guy that was there was Jim Ringo. He was a Green Bay Packers center. And in my heart and my mind, I said, I think I can be better than him. I can try to be better than him, and that's what I'm going to do. And I think there were a lot of guys like that on our offensive team I'm talking about that had the same type of attitude, that they weren't given the chance in the NFL, but they were going to prove that they could do it in the American Football League. And I enjoyed being with that type of guys. That's what I really enjoyed. I mean, there are stories about us guys that you don't want to print about you know, what the things that we did and stuff like that. But it was fun. We never hurt anybody. We never, you know, even like if we were all basically bachelors. We were, none of us guys were married. And there were, you know, ladies in Oakland didn't know who the Oakland Raiders were, you know.
Right.
But there were, I didn't marry a girl from Oakland. I married a gal from Miami. But there were some nice, we had some nice friendships with people in Oakland. They got to know us more on an individual basis than on a team basis. And to a certain degree, we liked it probably a little better to be on a personal basis. The team basis came with it, but, and that was, you know, it was fun.
But it was different then in that you guys all lived in and around the area. You didn't, like, you know, like today where if a guy's from Bradenton, Florida, plays for the Raiders and then goes home. You guys all lived in the area.
We did. There were some guys that lived at home, but we had some local guys that, you know, the Lake Merritt Hotel in Oakland, one whole floor was us guys. And the Raiders didn't pay for our room and board or anything like that at that time. We did,
right?
You know, and we in the morning, the maids had to be careful to walk up on that floor because there could be somebody with no clothes on walking to the elevator or doing whatever. And but it was just, you know, guys.
Yeah.
And we had one whole floor on the Lake Merritt Hotel.
Wow.
And it was exciting for me, and the various different things that if one guy couldn't think of something to do, the other guy had an idea to do something. So we'd go out to dinner here. We'd go out and drink beer here. We'd go and meet with some friends, you know, different things like that, new acquaintances. I think we were a good public relations for the beginning of the Oakland Raiders, because we moved around town quite a bit.
I've read some interesting things about that first offense. When Wayne Crowe was signed, one of the things that Wayne was told, as a halfback, you get to throw the football. And if you look at Tony Teresa's stats that year, he not only led the team in rushing, but he was a second or third leading passer on the team. What kind of offense did you guys run?
Well, it wasn't a shotgun. They call it something else. I can't remember what it was, but it was like the running gun, something like that. I know Red Conkright had this dream about running, you know, his offense and everything. But and Marty Feldman and Eddie Ertelas, you know, they had an offense more like maybe Navy, the Academy, because Eddie was there.
Right.
And he had, the Academy had some small backs, you know, and they could run. They were, it was a different type of feeling from college to the Raiders at that time, because it was, you know, a quick offense, very, very quick. We tried to do everything very quick on the short count and everything like that. And it was just, it was different, you know, and And it wasn't very productive, though. We didn't get the touchdowns that we should have. But it was halfway exciting, you know. Tony Teresa did throw passes. We had Tom Flores. Mm-hmm. Tom Flores was our quarterback, and Babe Parilli was there for a while.
Yeah, because I found he started two games as Tom's primary backup. What happened with Paul Larson? Paul Larson was signed, and he was supposed to be a big deal. He was supposed to be the guy.
He just, Paul Larson just didn't pan out. It was a big step from him. He went to Cal, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was a big step from him coming out of Cal going into this type of football. We didn't have great football players, but everybody tried to be great, you
right.
know. And there were a couple times, I think Paul had some injuries.
Mm.
And that set him back a little bit. And when it came down to the cuts and everything, he just, it was not there for him. And so that happens in football and surprises a lot of people
sure.
every year. Because
sure.
you think about Joe Doakes being the starting tight end. And he never makes it, you know.
Right.
And there's somebody else in there you never thought. But there were a lot of guys, and I kept in touch with a lot of those guys for a long time. But gosh, that's, you know, many years ago, 60 years ago.
Now, I remember years ago you and I talking about this. So 1960, you guys go 6-8. You kind of surprise everybody. You get some playmakers on the team. You get Jetstream Smith, Gene Probola, Charlie Hardy. What happens in 61 and 62? You had mentioned at the time when we talked about it that they didn't even know how to run practices. They didn't know what they were doing from just a organizational standpoint.
We were very unorganized in 61, 62. And we had coaches that probably didn't get along. You know, the head coach was Marty Feldman in 61, starting 61. He was an assistant coach at Stanford before he came to the Raiders. And I think coming into the Raiders and having the previous year experience with the Raiders as he did and taking over the very next season was very hard for him, and he didn't have assistants. That really used to burn me up. I could see that the assistants were not following the coach.
Mm.
They were not following the direction of the coach and doing it. And there was a lot of tension in there. And I think that there were a couple inside the limits of coaching, and they got to Mr. Valley and some of the others to eliminate a head coach and part of the staff.
Gotcha.
And that I was a very loyal guy, and I always thought that that loyal feeling, that loyal ability should be with the assistant coaches as well, and everybody, even the trainer,
right.
Everybody should be in the same wavelength, same thought.
1963, Al Davis is hired. And one of the things that he does is he changes the uniform. Goes from the black and gold Chicago Bears style uniform to what we have today.
It was, surprisingly, it was very well taken, you know. I mean, compared to what our uniform was before, that helped us become a different team. We were no longer that type of Raider with the black and gold and white. we were now with Silver and Black, and Mr. Davis talked about pride, and he talked about poise. And that was the first pride and poise that we talked about, was being in the Silver and Black, and remember who you play for, the Oakland Raiders, the Silver and Black Raiders. And that's what he basically really taught us a lot, you know, and he always emphasized that pride and poise and that Silver and Black, the colors of the Raiders. And as I recall, that's kind of how we transferred from the original colors into the Silver and Black colors. And, you know, everything that we had, the windbreaker type parkas and stuff like that for the sideline and everything, it took a while to get that stuff, you know,
sure,
because it had to be made and everything had to be approved by the American Football League. Mm. Anyway, we got it, and Al Davis was our head coach, and we got what we wanted and needed, and some of us probably got our jackets a little sooner than others because they were being made and all that, and
right.
But we were finally the real Oakland Raiders. We were finally the Silver and Black Oakland Raiders, and we were going to represent the Raiders in the Silver and Black uniform at all expense.
What do you recall about the 1967 season, and in particular, the 67 championship game against Houston?
It was an exciting season because this was, Al Davis had been with us as head coach for a couple of years, and then he became general manager, or he was head manager, or general manager and head coach.
Right.
And you know, we went into that 67 season really ready to become something, and his coaching staff that he picked was excellent. He had some very fine assistant coaches that, and Mr. Davis ran the team, you know, in a very organized manner. So everybody had to follow that organization type thing, and you can't be a winner without that. And we were able to put that all together. All of us players were in sync with the organization, with the Silver and Black, with the Raiders, with Al Davis and his coaching staff.
What was John Roush like?
John Roush was a real fine offensive coach. He followed Mr. Davis's lead with offense, and Mr. Davis was a brilliant offensive man. And John Roush followed him, and it was a very exciting year. I mean, we beat people up, and the thing of it is, we got to play Green Bay that year, and we just happened to be just a little bit greener than Green Bay, and you know, we came up short with the score. Being from Wisconsin, I wanted to represent my family and everybody there with a great game. I don't think I ever looked at the films of that game after the game or any time. But it was a thrill for me coming from Wisconsin. It was a thrill for a lot of other guys to be in Super Bowl II. And we played hard against Kansas City, the New York Jets, and everybody to get there.
Right.
And we had the ability to do the same thing against Green Bay, but we came a little short. And it was a big, important game for us.
Was it unusual for you guys early on that you didn't have specialists, you didn't have a true punter and a true kicker, that they were position players that did that job? Was that unusual? Because I know when Pete Golgolak came in with Buffalo in 64, and then he got poached by the Giants, you know, a few years later, it was a big deal. But in 1960, 61, 62, you know, George Fleming in 61's the kicker, Wayne Crowe's the punter, they're two halfbacks. Was that weird?
It was strange because there weren't a lot of true specialists for sure. And the emphasis on that was not that great. Mm. And nobody was looking for the punter. Nobody was looking for the field goal kicker and the holder and the receivers and all that stuff in those days. They thought that, like college, you would take one of your backs and put him back there to receive a punt, and he would be sufficient. And the same thing with punting the ball. You would have a guy, out at practice, he was kicking the ball, and we could see him doing such and such. But these guys were not true specialists.
Right.
They were not true specialists until you come to Gogolak, until you come to
Gene Mingo, right?
Mingo was a kicker, and he played safety as well.
Oh, did he?
You know, for the Broncos, and they had kickoff specialists. That some of the guys we swore had lead in their toe or their shoe, and stuff like that. And that's what the game has turned into now. We have those specialists. We have pass receivers. We have special guys that can run an out and up. We got guys that can run the ball on a punt in lieu of punting it. And the same thing with, we'll try a fake field goal and pass, and there's guys that can do that, and because of their ability. I think the football ability of athletes today is greater than it ever has, because the coaching they get in college, the coaching that then they also get in pro football to continue that ability in their line, and it's very good, and that's what makes the game exciting.
Those first couple of years, I've heard stories, and I think you may have told me this too, practice conditions weren't that great. Like some of the fields that you practiced on, where were some of the places you practiced, and what were the field conditions like?
We practiced on the Hayward High School field down in Hayward, right across from Capwell's, and that was one place we practiced. We practiced at the Navy shipyard in Alameda. Ertelatz was big with the Navy, so he'd make a call to Admiral Admiral Joe, we need a place to practice. What do you got? And they'd say, well, we got a field over there, or we got part of a field over there in Alameda. Why don't you go over there? Is there a place we can change clothes? Not this week, but next week we'll have it all set. So we'd change our uniform in our apartment or wherever we lived, and then go and get on the bus and go to Alameda and practice. And so that's the type of thing it was to begin with. And I can remember at Hayward High School, when that finally came about, we could be there. We were there for a whole season plus, and it was good to have a home like that where we could practice.
Right.
And things didn't change until Mr. Davis came.
Sure.
And when Mr. Davis took over as general manager and head coach, things changed, and he had people that were organized so they could do these changes and stuff like that. So it was more gratifying to play football in that situation than for me it had been the first 3 years.
What do you remember about the AFL-NFL rivalry as far as teams stealing other teams' players and just kind of how the merger all came about? Because, there was a common draft before there was ever the full merger. There were common preseason games before the full merger. What do you remember about that time? Because that was around the time you were playing for the AFL championship.
Well, the press always tried to belittle the American Football League and never give us much credit. And in doing so, they built and made some stars out of the NFL players. And we didn't get that stardom for some of our guys, that were very good, very competitive. And, so in seeing that, we would be fired up because we wanted to prove that We had guys that could block down on a defensive tackle, like a deep, an offensive tight end, and make a block and be able to cut the corner with a good running back like Clem Daniels or someone. And we knew we could do that. And we just needed a chance to show that we could do it. And we were getting tired of listening to the dialogue and stuff in the paper and on television. And our players were, and there were some that were, you know, very capable and better than some of the NFL players, and we knew that. And as we kept going and we won the championship that year against Houston Oilers, we were ready for the Super Bowl. It's just that we had a little bit of lack of experience with some players, and they were questionable as we played. We played our hearts out, every one of us, but still there was just that much of a weakness. Because the next year, the third year, what did we do? The American Football League, they won.
Right.
And they were there, you know, Kansas City, you know, they had that ability to do it. And so in that victory, I was very proud of those guys, even though we weren't there.
You know, Coach, one of the things that you said leading into that, and what I take away from almost every conversation I've ever had with Jim, is that, yeah, he's got to be the toughest guy I've ever known. And as you said, to a fault. And, you know, not only in football, but in life, you know, Jim's a tough guy.
Tough guy, you know, tenacious attitude, and a very likable guy, because he'll laugh at everything. You know, he would get knocked on his butt. He'd get up smiling and laughing and go back to the huddle. You know, wouldn't make a big thing out of go back to the huddle. And then, you know, if it was a cheap shot, the offensive linemen have a way of getting back to the guys when, you know, on the other side of the ball. They're not they're control. I call them control violence, the way they play, because just the nature of the position, as opposed to the defensive player who's just wild and crazy all the time. But he was that way as a player and as a friend. He was very, very accommodating, would do anything for you. Just a guy, good guy. One of the rare guys that you meet that's accomplished as much as he has, an exception, because he's never, he knew he was good, but it didn't over, his head didn't swell because it was already big anyway.
Well, you know, you got to fit it into that helmet, right?
Yep.
So we talked about it a little bit ago, in that we had Dave Dalby come in after Jim, and you know, Jim retires in 74, you know, the 75 preseason. Mm-hmm. A year later, the team goes to the Super Bowl in 1976, Super Bowl 11, and plays the Minnesota Vikings. And Dave Dalby is the point man at center. And Dave went on to a long career after that. What was it about Dave that made him a good player?
He was solid. He wasn't very fast, but he was quick. And he was just square. We like to call him square because he was solid. He had good balance, thick. Torso, and you look at offensive linemen, it's like you're looking at a breed of cattle or something. It's, you know, good legs, good structure here, and good that. But you, offensive linemen have a certain way they're built that have a better leverage than other players of that size. But he had it all. But the main thing was he loved the game. I mean, he loved the game and the practices and the training camp and the trips. Everything. He was always involved in organizing everything. The annual hockey game, air hockey game, the rookie parties. I mean, Dave was a true Raider, and he had a long career, and unfortunately, we lost him a few years later. Yeah.
Yes, very very unfortunate that that Dave Dalby is no longer with us. After Dalby, kind of the you talk about body type, you end up with a guy who's not a stereotypical center from body type in Don Mosbar. What was he, 6'7"? Big guy, tall guy, and he becomes the starting center for a long time.
Well, but he had. He had a long torso and shorter legs, you know, so he wasn't long-legged, we like to call him. You know, he had a better body. He had a great body for an offensive tackle, and he was. He would have been good wherever we put him, tackle, guard, center. But since our, you know, Dave was gone and our center, we didn't have – we had a good center, but none of the quality of Mosbar. They moved him. He moved to center, and then after I left, he unfortunately had that accident on his eye, and it cut short of what would have been a great career.
Right. I still find it amazing that from 1960 to 1994, 34 years, the Raiders had three starting centers.
Yeah, that's remarkable. Yeah, that is. Yeah, we had more coaches than that in 1 year, didn't we?
Maybe not 1 year, but yeah, over the course of 2 years, yeah, probably, yes. You're listening to Once a Raider, Always a Raider, the new podcast. I'm your host, Jerry Nack, and I'm joined by two-time Super Bowl champion head coach Tom Flores. Tom, definitely want to invite you back to the program. Love to have you on a regular basis to offer your insights and wisdom and memories and recollections of a storied career with the Raiders. But, you know, the football team, radio announcer, all of that is just part of who you are. You are also very, very involved in your community. What's going on with Tom Flores and his charity endeavors?
Well, I have started this foundation in 1988 in my hometown of Sagar, California, which is in the Central Valley outside of Fresno. Just about 12 miles east of Fresno, right before you get to the foothills of the Sierras. And I started it benefiting. There's 14 kindergarten through 8th grade schools in the area. And every year we give equal monies to each school. 1 year it's for the department, for the science department. 1 year it's for fine arts. And the other year is for athletics. And it's worked well. I mean, we've been in existence a long time. The the purpose of it was to enhance the educational experience, make it fun, do things, you know, that, you know, look, I'll give you an example of what we did. 1 year we took an entire fifth grade to see the Nutcracker Suite. And now these are kids from a farming community that probably would have never seen that in their lifetime. Maybe some would, a handful, but they loved it. It's something they will remember the rest of their lives. 1 year we took an outdoor basketball court. It had a bunch of chuck holes in it. We filled it up, made it a nice smooth surface. 1 year we bought microscopes, and you get the gist of the thing. And
yeah,
and it's fun to see the eyes of these kids. We're trying to make it fun so that when it comes a point in time. And they have to make a decision. Do I go on or do I just drop out and go find a job? They'll continue. And we don't have any statistics to that effect, but we have feedback on people that have succeeded and been part of and remember the foundation doing stuff for them.
If you were getting backlash, that's a different.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
it's a different
thing. Yeah. Yeah, feedback is what
feedback
you want. Backlash.
Yeah.
Yeah, backlash. No, not so much. Well, Tom, like I said, definitely want to have you back, and you know we'll have some conversation. We'll have you bring some guests with you, and we'll have some roundtable discussions and recollections and memories of your career and that of your teammates and players you coached.
Great. Anytime.
Well, Raider Nation, that's going to do it for the premiere of the Once a Raider, Always a Raider podcast. I have been Jerry Nack for Tom Flores. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you for listening to Once a Raider, Always a Raider on the official Raiders Podcast Network.